Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. I'm here with my co-host, Burl Love, and we kind of have a superstar guest today. I'm very excited.
We do have a superstar guest, so we should like get right to it. I mean, Thane Maynard.
I know, but
he's a busy guy.
He is, and that we went to the, you know, we were thinking about some upbeat topics for the podcast, and we're like, oh, the Festival of Lights. We should have, it's been a minute since he's a repeat guest, which we love.
He is, and we just talked about, too, having that, my New Year's resolution for the That's So Cincinnati, Cincinnati podcast is to have That's So Cincinnati podcast coffee mugs, and that way we can give them to our guests, especially like Thane, who's a repeat guest. I feel bad we have nothing to give him today when he comes.
Well, it's so much better to do the podcast in person. You guys can always tell. Sometimes you do have to do it remote. And it's better to be in person. And that's how good conversations
So speaking of upbeat topics, before we have Thane come in, we have a big soccer match happening here this weekend.
We do.
As we sit here on a Friday, tomorrow will be Hell is Real, the playoff version.
Yes, Hell is Real 3, almost like for the season.
I know. So FC Cincinnati playing their arch nemesis, the Columbus Crew.
Yes.
And the winner goes to the Super Bowl of American soccer.
Correct. The playoffs, that is how they look, the kind of, you know, in the conferences and play.
And that match could be here.
Yeah, I will be here because we're the number one, I guess, seed is the word.
Right, assuming they beat the Crew, which, you know, that's going to be a tough game.
No, we're good.
So
we have players coming back from injuries. I went to the last playoff game. I was in the Bailey.
That's fantastic.
You know, it was no score the whole game, and it was kind of cold. And so in soccer, it would have been, you would have had to go 30 more minutes. 15 and 15.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you're like, and then it would have gone to penalty kicks if we didn't. But we scored in that last second. It was so exciting.
So let's just talk briefly about what does this mean for the program, the team, the city? Think back to 5 years ago now when FC Cincinnati was working on its bid to become an MLS team. They didn't have a stadium. There was, you know, community discussion, debate about where to put it. Then they get the MLS bid. They have kind of a rocky start once they're in the MLS. Have they come of age? Is it premature to say that?
Really, no other way to put it. We have a player that is the MVP. Our coach is like coach of the year. There's no other way to say they won the trophy. Not the trophy, the shield.
The shield.
I actually have a very good handle on how all of the cups work and everything. So I just misspoke because I'm pretty proud of myself for understanding how it all works.
Well, we had Jeff Birding here, the co-CEO of FC Cincinnati, talking about what they learned and how they adapted. So, you know, we can link back to that podcast. But yeah, a very upbeat time here.
It was very exciting. So we went, I'll talk about this a little bit when we get to our special guest segment.
All right.
We went to the Festival of Lights last night. And so for us, we had to come downtown, get my car because I was at work before I went there. And the whole city was lit up orange and blue.
It
was very beautiful. And, you know, we've seen it for the Reds. We've seen it for the Bengals. And it was really great to see. And you could just feel that energy just from, you know, what the skyline looked like last night.
So do you know what 1990 is?
I don't.
1990 is the last time a professional Cincinnati sports team won a championship. That would be the Reds winning the World Series wire to wire against the Oakland A's.
Wow. No pressure, FC Cincinnati.
1990 feels like it should be 10 years ago, but no. 1990.
Yes, I'm aware, Burl. I was in high school.
Is 33 years ago. So it's been a minute since Cincinnati has had a championship pro team.
I'm excited. I'm taking Jack.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And like, we're going to finish this off and we're going to see it all the way to the end. I have faith.
All right. Well, good luck to FC Cincinnati. And let's bring on the 90-second naturalist.
Special special guest time here on That's So Cincinnati. I'm so excited to welcome back Thane Maynard, the director of the zoo, who really needs no introduction. We all know who he is. We've all been to the zoo, and we know his voice, so that's perfect for podcasting from the 92nd Naturalist.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me.
Did you bring a 92nd Naturalist tidbit for us today?
Well, I am going to record later today, so I have one story that will be on how some insects hover and some don't. You know, big butterflies can't. They just flap around. But
yeah,
huge numbers do. You know, flies, wasps, bees, even some moths. It's amazing. They beat their wings over 110 times per second in order to pull that off. It's very tricky.
Like a hummingbird.
Yeah, like a hummingbird, the mechanics are simpler. A bird, if you think of it, a bird has our exact structure. I mean, our same skeleton, our same musculature. That's a phenomenon, because if you hold a hummingbird in your hand, you can't even feel that it's there. But for an insect to pull it off, it has this crazy ball and socket joint so their wings can do a figure eight.
Do you find it hard to come up with topics for it, or is there's just an endless list of things? After, I mean, how many years have been you? Decades,
yeah, be careful
right?
what you wish for, right? It's 36 years.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what it's like is for years I ran the Flying Pig Marathon. And the only thing you need to do to run a marathon is to make sure you like to go running. Because when you see friends that are out running, like, I hate this. When are we going to be done? You're like, well, you shouldn't train for the pig because all you're going to do is run.
Right.
But once you realize that, you're like, let's get out and run. It'll be all right. So if you do stories every week, you're like, that's an interesting thing. And, you know, you'll see little tidbits and journal references, and one thing leads to the next.
So we already went down the rabbit hole. He's been on this podcast for like less than a minute, and we're talking about insects that hover and ball socket joints. And I wish we had this on video because Thane actually demonstrated the motion that they make. So, well, like Sherry said, welcome back. Everybody knows you. They know your voice. And we wanted to talk to you just because there's been a lot happening. Mm-hmm. I mean, you got a busy job. Whether it's trying to get levees passed or trying to get elephants transported down the highway. Should we start with the elephants?
Mm-hmm. Let's do it.
Let's do it.
That's certainly our big news this year. You know, for the, more than the last year, we've been building our big elephant facility. If folks haven't been to the zoo recently, you might not have noticed. It's in what used to be our big back parking lot. And it's a great big facility. In total, it's 7 acres with a 5-acre yard, a gigantic barn. Honestly, the barn is probably not as big as the Cintas Center, but that's what it feels like when you go and look in it, because it is quite big. And that's needed because we're growing our herd. So yes, just 2 weeks ago, we flew in 4 elephants, a whole family from the zoo in Dublin, Ireland. A grandmother, her daughter, and then they each have young offspring. And them coming as a family group has really been great. They, from the second they got off the trucks, it, you know, hung together, and they have done great. So that's
they're joining our.
That's right. We have 4. Okay. That's right. So we'll have a total of 8. Those 4 are together right now in this new barn. There's also an outside yard they can go to when the weather's good. We're still finishing up the rest of the exhibit that won't open until next summer. But Sabu, our male, is up in Columbus Zoo. He has a couple of girlfriends up there, and breeding Asian elephants, you know, they're very endangered. It's not always successful, but he is a prized male in that his genes aren't that much represented in the population.
Okay.
A big challenge for zoos is very few animals come out of the wild anymore, so you've got to carefully manage for genetic diversity. So hopefully he'll get a female or two pregnant up there. He'll come back after the new year and get with this group that's here. And we certainly think they'll fold in fine. He's numerous times gone into different herds. And the way elephants work, there's one big dominant male who is not in charge, but can play an important role. There's young animals that came, and he'll play a role in that. Elephants, this will sound kind of silly, but are like people. You probably know humans live in matriarchies. If you don't think so, ask your mother. She'll explain that to you. But elephants certainly do. And so the grandmother coming with her daughter is what really is the cohesion that holds this herd together.
So when Sherry and I were preparing for this, she reminded me that the gestation period for an elephant is 2 years.
Yeah, yeah.
So it'll be a while. in Columbus before we see if...
Right.
Yeah.
Well, now if there's an elephant that's pregnant.
Right. Well, today with all kinds of tests, you know, we have a huge reproductive biology program in our zoo, CREW, our Center for Conservation and Research of Endangered Wildlife. So there are tests, just like with humans, you can tell if someone's pregnant. But in our case, the reason we're bringing all these elephants in and growing this herd is we want to be committed to the future that 50 years from now, Sensei Zoo will have elephants. In order to do that, we need to have a large multi-generational herd and a facility where they can all live. You know, the days of individual elephants or one or two, that's basically passing, I think. There's lots of concern, a thoughtful concern, when people ask about, gosh, elephants are huge, they move around a lot, you know, how do you make sure you're giving them the best life? So it's kind of a either go big or go home for elephants. Lots of zoos have gotten out of the elephant business. Louisville is sending their final ones to a sanctuary in Tennessee. Heck, the whole state of, or the whole country of Canada is outlawing elephants. Like the Toronto Zoo, which has a terrific zoo, is having to get rid of their elephants. They're going to send them to a sanctuary in California.
Because of the space issues.
Well, in their case, I think it's a function of the Toronto Zoo's part of it. It's a city zoo, Calgary, the same kind of thing. And I just think there was pressure, animal rights type pressure of, gosh, should we have elephants? The answer to that, the definitive answer, I think, is what my friend Jane Goodall says, who's very, very interested in animal rights, which is good zoos do a good job. And everyone can differentiate between, you know, sort of a roadside Tiger King kind of mess, you know, with inbreeding and all sorts of craziness versus an accredited good zoo that's saying, okay, how do we run this program for decades?
And you mentioned this, but I think you said 7 acres is what you've added to the...
Yeah, by taking that big back parking area. Mm-hmm. So that's the barn and the yard, but then all the way up the hill, we have a great new pavilion area that's on the regular days, kind of a picnic area, but also we have like for Festival of Lights. I don't know if you got up, but that's where Santa Claus is, and it's a neat multi-use space. So that whole Asian section of the zoo's a big new addition, much like over the decade ago, we built a big Africa exhibit in our former parking lot. So that's how we've been able to grow.
How cold does it need to be before the elephants need to go inside? What can they tolerate?
Yeah. It's hard to get an elephant to cool off very fast. So on the coldest day of the year, they would be able and be allowed to go out a little while and come back in because they're not real fragile versus, say, giraffes, which are obviously skinnier, but also you do not want a giraffe to fall down on the ice because that'll be the end of things, where obviously an elephant's not going to fall down. Mm-hmm. So, but that said, when it's below 40 or frankly, really cloudy and rainy and cold, you know, they might not go out much for that day. But with our up and down winter, it's a nice setup that we have because the barn's there, but so are the yards. So they'll be able to go out certainly for part of the time on really any day.
I know it was like 28 degrees on Tuesday, and then we went to the Festival of Lights last night.
Yeah.
And it was 50 degrees,
yeah.
And it was a lovely night for
it. I know.
Winter in Cincinnati. So that's opening summer 2024?
Correct. Yeah.
That's going to be exciting.
So let's go over a little bit about how the elephants got here, because it almost sounds like the start of a joke. Like, how do you get an elephant from Dublin to Cincinnati?
Yeah. Well, people can't fly nonstop Dublin to Cincinnati, but elephants can. But you have to charter a plane. So it was a great big 747 for shipping not just animals, but any other things. You know, it's a big empty plane on the inside, which when you see one of those, there's not for humans, you know, have places to sit and stuff. It's actually cavernous.
I was imagining like a military transport plane that can carry like, you know, Hummers and small artillery vehicles, something along those lines. But it was just a 747.
That's right. There are some zoos one time that imported a tremendous herd from Africa, and they pulled some strings with colleagues and somehow with the military and flew on a great big plane. And those planes are so big, you could probably put this plane in them. I mean, they're really big.
Right.
But these, while they were big, fit in there. They're custom crates that the zoo had made in Ireland. They, for the two big females, the animals weigh about 10,000 pounds and the crate weighs about 10,000 pounds. So they were 20,000 pounds. They're these giant forklifts that somehow get them up into the plane and then very, 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 very carefully maneuver them slowly, slowly to get them exactly where they need to be and sort of clicked into place. Because you can't take a 20,000 pound object and bang it around in a plane. The plane's real fragile. The younger animals that came are 5 and 6 years old. So their boxes and crates were smaller and probably total weighed maybe 15,000 pounds.
Just 15,000 pounds.
Yeah. But, they flew over nonstop and it's very complex, more complex than I had ever thought it would be because you'd think, okay, these are animals born in captivity. They have every health inspection. They're coming nonstop from that health inspection to our health inspection. But holy moly, I mean, you know, they're protected by the Endangered Species Act. They're protected by a thing called CITES, which is the Convention on International Trade of Endangered Species. So you have the Department of Agriculture, I mean, on the ground involved. You've got U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. You got every possible permit needed. And it was something. It took more than a village to get those elephants here. On landing, it sort of became a slow motion process. Again, just everybody wanted to be super duper safe.
At CBG.
Mm-hmm. And it ended up, they had to get off the plane and then onto great big flatbed trucks.
Which still involved, in the crate?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were in the crate until they went into the big barn. But it involved these great big cranes lifting them up. And you're like, holy moly. And blessedly, the animals, they had trained them for quite a while. The keepers there, as well as some of our keepers, went over to Ireland. So they were used to the crates. They'd been fed in the crates. They'd slept in the crates. So they weren't, you know, rocking around. But I can tell you, it's nerve-wracking to see a great big cat with your elephant in it moving around, floating through at CVG. Or in Avondale at the zoo, it had to swing way around to get, you know, on the side of the barn. So once they were on the trucks and ready to go, state troopers and sheriffs were directly involved.
It was an
entourage.
I will put up the video somehow, maybe on Twitter.
Yeah, we can put it on there with the podcast article. I saw the video.
The video, right, Thane? Uh-huh. Did your video?
Our team did. I didn't. But we have.
It looked like a presidential motorcade.
The truth is, that's exactly what it felt like. Where everybody's very cautious, clearing roads. Even down by the zoo, you know, we had zoo staff out and certain roads closed down. Just to make sure everybody just got in and there wasn't like, oh, good grief, somebody crashed their Volkswagen into a pole or something. Just keep it going. And it did remind me very much of whether it's in Cincinnati when a president has come or if you're in D.C. and something's going on where you can just tell, okay, something important's happening here because nothing else is happening. And it fortunately went very, very smoothly. It did take a while to get all that done with the trucks and the cranes. But then they walked in one at a time and the four of them together, it was as if they just like came in and hugged it. They are their family and their herd. And that went even better than anyone would expect. So we're very excited about that. And
then do you introduce our elephants like one at a time? Or was it like a family and a family?
Right now, just the four are in the new barn.
Okay.
And our other three females are in the old barn.
Okay.
And Sabi will be back. And he'll go in with them first because he'll be certainly a part of kind of shaping that herd with the younger animals. Then we will bring the other three females down there next year, call it spring, and introduce them a bit at a distance. So it's a great big barn. So there's lots of parts where people can be or the elephants can be. And the same thing in the yards. There's different yards. So just as they get more familiar one with another. So it'll be a good process and certainly fun to see so many elephants at our zoo.
The elephant you referenced, did you say Simon? What's the name of our male elephant?
Sabu.
Sabu. Yeah. Okay, so that's who you're going to be introducing. But he's in Columbus now. He'll come back.
Right.
Well, he's going to be busy.
he will. But he's a real good elephant. Yeah, he really is. You know, elephants are big. Elephants can be dangerous. Bull elephants can be dangerous. But
no, they're so cute.
He's very tractable. He knows his keepers real well. So it's a solid program, yeah.
When the exhibit opens, will it be among the largest in the country?
It will. Yeah, it will. I can think of some places that have more space. It's not for the public, but there's an endangered species breeding center north of Jacksonville called White Oak Conservation Center. And boy, they ended up buying all the elephants from Ringling. So they currently have 28 elephants, but they're going to grow that herd because I think they bought 42 from Ringling. And now imagine you have a breeding center and you don't have any revenue from visitors and you're doing all that. They have a obviously a billionaire supporter that
sure.
makes that happen. But I mean, that's a facility. I mean,
right. That's, yeah. But as far as city zoos, this will be one
yeah,
of the,
well, yeah. And certainly because it's brand new, best in class. I mean, yeah. it's a remarkable barn. 4 foot deep of heated sand. So the heat's coming up from the floor. And there's some stalls for various management reasons are still concrete, but the big mixing area in the middle, which is looks like the football field, and most of the others are all sand, which is, you know, better for them, partly to just give their joints a break. But also the keepers each morning can, with literal bobcats, create different sort of structures, and then during the day the elephants fuss with them or lay on them or they stick plants in them, you know.
Heated sand.
That sounds lovely. Yeah.
I need heated sand.
Exactly. It's like going to the beach.
So recently you were here meeting with our editorial board talking about the levy, which we'll get to in a minute, but one of the things that I learned in that discussion, which in retrospect makes total sense, but it's just something you don't think about, is that you have had to adapt the medical staff of the zoo because in captivity, animals actually live longer than in the wild. And so the issues we have as human beings with getting older, arthritis, you know, blocked arteries, whatever it is, things that we confront because we live to 70, 80, 90 years old. Now, animals that wouldn't have had those situations have them because they live longer. And so your medical team has had to become specialists on, what did you call it?
Geriatric
care for animals.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a good news, bad news thing. Because of nutrition and in veterinary care, animals live a lot longer than they used to. And I don't mean over like a 100-year period, but just in relatively recent memory, we would have our, you know, we're famous for our cheetahs. We run cheetahs in our cheetah show. If we had a cheetah live to 10 or 11, you'd be like, wow, how about that? Well, now they'll live to 19. Well,
And average in captivity or in the wild would be what?
Oh, it'd be brief.
Yeah.
An animal like a cheetah has to be 100% in order to catch prey.
Top of their game.
Yeah, absolutely top
young,
of their game.
Young, spry, no injuries.
So they would live shorter lives. And that's true of most animals. End up with all sorts of pressure. Sometimes that's competition or being eaten. It can be a parasite load. It can be also just not able to keep up. So that's true of anything, but particularly top predators, they're either 100% or they're not going to make it.
Wow.
So nonetheless, the nice thing for our zoo, we also have a farm out in the country and quote unquote, some animals go out to pasture. And if we have an older arthritic zebra, it'll be 100% fine there, where it might not as be so much at the zoo. The mix-up with that is if you have an arthritic polar bear, you have an arthritic sea lion. I mean, you can't send those out to Loveland. I mean, they, you know, need to be in specialized facilities. But yes, medical care at the zoo has vastly been elevated decade by decade. Yeah, we now have 3 full-time veterinarians, 4 full-time vet techs who take care of all the animals in the zoo. We also have in our research program, I mentioned 8 PhDs that are reproductive biologists, 4 of whom are also veterinarians. So now that's all up from when I started at the zoo. We didn't even have a veterinarian. It was like farm. If the animal didn't get up or didn't eat, we called a veterinarian. And of course, you wouldn't be able to do it that way now for all kinds of reasons. And one is animals are very hard to get. This sort of sounds callous looking back, but in the 70s, zoo directors just called up an animal dealer and said, I need more gibbons. Send somebody to Borneo and catch me a gibbon. And I'm not kidding. Somebody banged around in the forest till they got a gibbon and they put it on a boat and it came. There are so many reasons you could not do that anymore. For zoonotic diseases, particularly with primates, endangered species rules, criticism. I mean, nobody's banging around in the forest capturing bonobos or gibbons either. So we need to keep them all healthy.
So we should have done in the beginning because you mentioned, you know, how long you've been at the zoo, but tell us how long you've been at the zoo, how you got to the zoo, just the quick, you know, the 90 second Thane Maynard story.
Go. Yeah, exactly. Well, I've been there since 1977. And so I've seen this great renaissance of our zoo. The zoo's been around 150 years, so there have been a number of great Renaissance times. During the Depression was a big one at our zoo and nationwide. San Diego Zoo was built by the WPA because it was built during the Depression. And a lot of our zoo was built as well. You know, it was used a lot of concrete, and that's what those guys did. Mm-hmm. But starting in the 70s with, you know, new programs, the reason I got a zoo job is Proctor built the world's first zoo education center. And it had five classrooms and a full-time high school. And just by right place, right time, I learned they might need somebody to help lead programs. And so that's how I got it. I mentioned that because today, through two generations of kids growing up to zoo camp and things, 300 qualified biology graduates would want that job because there's tremendous interest. And zoos are small businesses. There are only so many mm-hmm. jobs. But yeah, so as the saying goes, my mother dropped me off and never came back to pick me up. So that's how it worked.
That's a great story. So you've been at the zoo since 77. Are you from this area? Where did you?
I'm not. My wife grew up in Cincinnati. The world's run by hormones, so guys chase women all over the world. And I ended up in Cincinnati. And she had a job here writing for Cincinnati Magazine right out of college. And I was in graduate school and didn't have a job. And you probably met young guys, they don't think much about it. And suddenly one day you've married your college girlfriend and you realize I should probably get a job because I had planned to go to Africa and bang around in a truck. But one day you wake up and realize I don't think I'm going to do that.
Well, it's also a very Cincinnati thing to do to bring back your spouse for a man or a woman. You bring back, you know.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of which, I love the title.
Because we have everything that we need here. We're a small,
great.
A small, big city. We have a zoo. We have an opera. We have all the things.
Yeah, I agree.
Three professional Super sports livable. Teams. Yeah.
And by the way, I had failed to mention, I love the title, That's So Cincinnati, because that alone, that is a Cincinnati thing. I love that. Yeah.
You know what?
People ask about your high school.
At the end of the podcast, we're going to let Burl tell the story of how that name came to be.
Okay.
Because it was started before I was on the podcast, so I actually don't know.
Well, I don't think I know either. We probably stole it from somebody.
All right, fine. We'll talk about it next week at the end of the podcast.
I'll have to do some research.
Ask Jason Williams. He'll know.
So I touched on, you met with our editorial board. Mm-hmm. Originally, you were seeking a levy with an increase. The county commission said, no, not this time. Mm-hmm. Cincinnati Zoo, you've got other ways to get money. Then you went for the renewal that passed. What was the reaction when the increase wasn't approved? Was there a moment of panic? Was there just a pivot in how you go after funding? Mm-hmm. Because you mentioned, the vets on staff, the PhDs, all the regulations that have to be met and the staff to manage them. For those who don't know, the zoo basically is a self-sustained off the grid when it comes to water. You guys have you manage your own water. You just have so many programs and such. What was as the director of the zoo, as the person that is charged with keeping it in business, how did you react after the county commission said, nope, we're not going to approve an increase for the ballot this year?
Yeah, there was some disappointment for sure, just because I think common sense would say, whether it's the zoo or it's children's services, A, is it worth doing? Yes. Well, therefore, it ought to increase with inflation, because how else are you going to do it? So that just is what makes sense to me. But nonetheless, we have the system we have. We certainly made our case. We even convinced the Tax Review Committee to endorse it. But the system, it's a clumsy one, but it's the system we have. So we were very glad to get the renewal. It's 15% of our annual budget and keeps the zoo affordable. And so that's all a part of it. Most zoos receive a lot more. Say Columbus Zoo, for instance, they've been getting $20 million since the beginning of the tax levies back in the 82, which if you go to Columbus Zoo, that explains how it's so big and grand. But nonetheless, our system works. We are fortunate. This is a zoo town. And I mean it. If I go from Cleves to Terrace Park to give a talk, I can just say, hey, did any families here have any zoo stories? And everybody does. Their kids went to zoo camp or grew up to be veterinarians or all sorts of things where they were involved. And over time, we've grown to be the biggest draw in town, biggest draw in the county. And so we make it work.
And you occasionally score some big gifts from the philanthropists of the world, including this year there was a major gift.
We do. We've just come off of a great big capital campaign that was successful. That's another unique thing. We raise more private money by a mile than other zoos, which is that you talk about. That's so Cincinnati. That's so Cincinnati. If you think the level of the performing arts, the fine arts, the zoo, the museum center, that's all private money making those things thrive. So that's a really neat thing. Most zoos receive a preponderance of that sort of support from local tax base for, say, new exhibits and things, and we raise it privately. So we've had some terrific donors. Harry and Linda Pfaff were certainly our lead donor on our big capital campaign, and at an equal amount, a man named Hugh Hoffman, who was a friend of the zoo, passed away and left his whole estate. So he gave a huge gift to UC, the Nature Center, which his family founded back in the 70s, the Cincinnati Zoo, and really something. Very generous, quiet man. I traveled with him a lot, and never did he play the card of, excuse me, I'm very fancy, I live in Indian Hill, I went to Yale, I'm from a generation. No, nothing.
So you knew him. Just that a nice was not guy. A surprise.
I did know him. Okay. I did travel with him. I'd been to his house, but yes, it was a surprise. Yes. He was a quiet and generous man.
So you touched on a little bit how things have changed as far as animal rights activists, people who, you know, like you mentioned, Canada. I think you said they passed a law saying elephants are no longer allowed to be kept.
And citations as well. They're having to get rid of all the orcas and whales and dolphins in captivity in Canada.
So what is the case for zoos today in 2023? Sure.
I'll say a couple of things. One is we're fortunate at Cincinnati Zoo to have this long tradition, and really it's a zoo town. And so we built up a lot of trust with folks. So not often, but sometimes someone, perhaps college students, perhaps their mothers, would contact the zoo and have a question about animal rights, or they might protest or something. And we have a longstanding, you know, decades longstanding policy of, if that's the case, we invite them over. Come, bring your group, bring your video camera. Because I promise, if you spend an hour really seeing what zoos do today, modern zoos, it's the research and science, it's the conservation, it's the husbandry, it's very different than people imagine. A lot of times people imagine things that they either saw in history books or they heard about or they think, oh, it's not fair. And we go to, I don't know who has a dog at home and thinks they take care of their dog. We go the distance of taking care of animals. Like, it is just crazy how the detail we go to for husbandry. But the case for zoos certainly is why they've always been there, which is we're there to show animals to people. You know, if a four-year-old's going down the road and sees a zoo billboard and there's a picture of an animal and the word zoo, they know what it is. And that's a value. The challenge for us is to make sure in a changing world, we're still relevant to this community and relevant to those families and offer something they value, but also offer something that's really important. And zoos have emerged. There's no doubt about it. You know, in the 70s when I started, it did not have the level of science, conservation, in-depth education. Our education programs now, I mean, active educations you can enroll people in, start at 18 months, and you can go all the way through and get a master's degree through the zoo, through Miami University. So we sort of bring that full breadth and depth of telling the story of animals, but also getting people engaged.
And learning through experience.
Yeah.
I mean, as we go along.
Like, it's important to see an elephant.
The generation now is about experiences.
Yeah. And I've had people say, why do we really need to have this, say, animals? Why don't we just watch videos on our phone? And people watch a lot of our animals on their phone, I know. But you have to admit, seeing Fiona right in front of you swimming and showing off, she's very people-focused, is very different than seeing it on your phone, even though it's fun to see it on your phone, too.
That's for sure.
Which she's turning 7.
I know.
Hard to imagine.
Wait,
she's a January birthday.
Fiona's 7 years old. So what's the dog years math with hippos? 7 years is a full adult, right?
She is. She's, much to my chagrin, she's cycling and periodically mating with Tucker, but she's on birth control.
But of course, there's the news we were looking for, Sherry. That's the headline. Fiona.
Yeah, that'll be like my whole rest of my month.
Any Fiona headline is going
to. Well, you don't want her to get pregnant and have. Is she too young to do that?
Yeah, at this time, she's still growing.
Okay.
She's, but she's getting big. She's 2,400 pounds.
Okay.
But her mom's 3,400 pounds. And, but yeah, we'll manage that. But she'll have a baby down the way. But right now we have Fritz.
That
it's going to take
point,
him.
Though, right?
Yeah.
She would do that eventually.
Well, often, most often, baby animals are born at the zoo and then they go to another zoo for genetic reasons. You don't want to breed with their dad. However, Fiona's our franchise player, so she's staying.
agree. Even though apparently there's a lot of hippos that would like to see her in other zoos. Oh, yeah. No, we can never let her go.
Yeah, she's been like lightning in a bottle. It's hard to.
In the little zoo shop, all the Fiona ornaments were sold out. The other ones are there.
There's a new play at the Ensemble Theater about
Fiona.
Yes,
there is. Yeah.
So my son is a 2-year veteran of zoo camp.
There you go.
And I remember I wanted to like see the whole zoo. I could not get him out of the insect world.
Yeah.
That was his jam. Like we could have spent 5 hours in the insect world. Just, yeah. And I think his, you know, what he likes to do, he's into keeping fish right now, certainly was sparked by what he saw at the zoo and talking to the counselors at zoo camp and everything like that. The insect world, I remember, was, you know, brand spanking shiny new, kind of innovative at the time.
Oh, boy,
That's coming up on, that's got to be 20 years, 25 years.
Oh, no, it opened in 78.
Wow.
Yeah, that was one of our big leaps forward, that and the Outdoor Gorilla Center, as well as the Education Center that I mentioned. It was all sort of that late 70s time. But yeah, that facility's had a big impact. Zoo camp has. I mean, I have three kids. They went to zoo camp and two of them became biologists. So
yeah.
Be careful.
Well, I know. And then into your name baked in is Botanical Gardens.
Yeah.
So talk to us just briefly. What is the staffing? What is the, you know, how do you keep the zoo looking so lush and green and live? And
well, you probably know some people that are gardeners, you know, avid gardeners. So you can imagine a horticulture team is that entire sort of mojo where, you know, if you stop and talk with them, they're like, okay, that's great, but I've got to go plant some plants. I mean, they're just after it.
I've got to go snip some sucker branches off.
And they've got also lots of volunteers, many of whom are master gardeners. But it's like an anthill. It is. It's a lot. Because if you think of when you visit the zoo, we have a big focus on flowers. And so in the spring, of course, in April, we have our big tulip festival. And there's 110,000 tulips, all of which have to be planted. But then in May, when they're gone, they dig them all up. And then they plant annuals. Same thing over acres of the zoo. And it looks really great all the way till about October. And they dig them up and they put the tulip bulbs in again. And it takes a great amount of labor. And there's a dynamic tension between the animal team and the plant team, because the keepers would love to go out any chance they get with some stems and clip things off to feed to their animals.
Ah.
And other than bamboo, they try to regulate that and not do too much. Bamboo, fortunately, grows so darn fast, you can't even keep up with it. And a lot of animals will eat bamboo. Red pandas pretty much solely eat that, but elephants will chew through even the big stalks. And on one of our farms out in the Mason area, we grow a lot of plants to feed at the zoo as well.
How many farms do you have? You mentioned one in Loveland.
We are very fortunate over the decades. Two families have given us farms. The one in the Loveland area is the Mast Farm, and that's where we breed cheetahs, which was the initial purpose of it. And some species are easy to breed, like lions. They're used to living in a group. Bang, they're all in birth control because they breed every day. Cheetahs are hard to breed. They're very selective. They're very, by nature, nervous. But Tommy Tinnenfeld, who lives on that farm and has run it forever, he's like the cheetah whisperer, really. You go to a national zoo meeting, and he's like, yeah, Tommy's the man, because he's good at it. We've had, I think, 80 cheetahs born out there.
That's fantastic. That's amazing.
So, and zoos have specialties. We're good at breeding black rhinos, cheetahs, gorillas. We don't breed orangutans right now. I mean, you know, not everybody breeds everything. Anyway, yes, so we have that farm. It's 109 acres. It also has a number of older animals that are out there. Or if we end up with too many wild dogs, the wild dogs will stay out there until another zoo needs them. You know, it's like a release valve kind of thing. Then we have a great big farm, over 600 acres up in the Mason area, which was a gift from the Boyer family way back in the 90s. And we don't have animals up there, but we have our big native plant program, which we use at the zoo and also throughout the community to promote pollinators. We grow our own hay up there. We also put in a massive solar power setup with sheep that'll, you know, instead of mowing it, the sheep will mow it. And that's a thing in cooperation with some local companies, Malink Company, if you're familiar with Steve Malink. And yeah, all kinds of things up there. We grow a lot of trees. And as they grow, those branches will feed everything from elephants to giraffes. We reclaimed a great big wetland that had been dried out 80 years ago by putting in drainage tile. And that was an amazing thing. 50 acres, you just pull out the drainage tile. And I mean, that thing becomes a wetland in one season.
Yeah.
Crazy.
So I did want to ask, going back to the animals, how Indume is doing.
Yeah.
And so we're in, we're recording on kind of a gloomy Friday morning, mm-hmm. and it was me and the court reporter of all people mm-hmm. were here early today, and he was reminding me of Indume's saga of coming from California that yeah. we wrote so much about, coming, returning to Cincinnati after being away for a mm-hmm. long time. How is he doing?
He's done well. Yeah, he has. We have three groups of gorillas at our zoo, and everybody probably knows gorillas live in troops or groups. And so one's a bigger breeding group. Then we have one that is new to the zoo. It's a bachelor group of just three males. And they came from the Detroit Zoo. And then, of course, we have Indume's group. And Indume is not going to breed. He's with two older females, which is perfect for him because, you know, these gals are veterans and they're calm and help him stay
calm.
It's
kind of like the Golden Bachelor.
Exactly. It's a lot like that.
Exactly. But he's not lonely, right? Because that was such a huge concern that he was lonely in California. Yeah. And so he's here and he has friends. Yeah. And
it was a task and a half that involved federal judges and Californian lawyers. But very fortunately, we had a simple one-page contract that said once Coco, who he had been out to be with, once she passed away, he'd come back. So he did. And that's worked out real well. When you come to the zoo, you might or might not see his group. We have two public areas, the outdoor yard, which in the middle of the winter doesn't get as much use, and then the new big indoor gorilla den. So on a given day, Indume's group or the bachelor group or the breeding group might be in one of those two. Part of the big improvement we did is there is an equal size space behind the scenes as a sort of a big husbandry bedroom area. So whichever troops not on exhibit is back in there. And so that's good. We're able to do a lot of training and other things.
Well, as we sit here, it's Festival of Lights time at mm-hmm. the zoo. That's a big time of year for visitors. And
to be featured on the Coolidge Christmas card.
Oh, good, good. I'm glad you came with your family. Yeah.
So should we plug that and wrap it up?
Yes. Because
I see Phil's sort of like given the – do you guys know how long this interview is running? Because I could talk
all day.
Oh, yeah,
Phil knows I don't care.
Yeah. Well, but yeah, Festival of Lights goes the rest of the month?
Yeah, until November 7th. It always depends where the calendar hits on holiday weekends, but
November 7th?
January.
I apologize.
That's right.
January 7th.
January 7th, yeah.
Thanks.
So you get that.
You can
first
see why
week
I need
January.
A radio producer. Yeah. January 7th, yes. And, you know, it's our biggest event of the year because it lasts 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And people come out. It's very weather dependent. The one thing that kills it is rain. Mm-hmm. Most people don't say, okay, it's going to be fun, honey. It's going to be 40 degrees and raining, you know, in the dark. But the cold doesn't bother folks. They come out.
You can get hot chocolate.
Oh, no. I highly recommend the mulled wine.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
It was delicious.
Yeah, good. So year by year, we add a lot of things. More lights. We've got some cherry pickers so they get taller and all that. Over 4 million lights. We've added a neat thing this year. There's a synchronized light show to Christmas songs on our lake. And folks can – I've only ever seen this at say, sports events – you go on an app and synchronize your phone with the system that's running it, and you're part of the show lighting up what's going on at the zoo. And it's amazing for lots of reasons because I've been at the zoo a long time. And I remember when the Festival of Lights started, it was, you know, a couple of dozen light strands strung around. You know, I mean, it was very modest.
Much more than that.
And now we've got people synchronizing their phones to it. So that's been fun to see those changes.
All right. Well, everybody get out to the zoo. I still have to get out there.
We have plenty of time.
It's only
December 1st.
I know.
We'll be there every night except Christmas night and until January 7th.
Except Christmas. Are you open every day? My son did ask this question. I thought it was a very good question because I did not know the answer.
Yeah.
Is the zoo open every day?
Historically, we were, but we now give folks a break. So we're closed on Thanksgiving Day and Christmas Day.
Okay.
But every other day.
All right.
My answer was probably,
yeah,
because someone has to be there to take care of the animals anyway. Yeah.
As the zoo has grown and become more professionalized, there are a lot more people there doing all kinds of things. In fact, during the pandemic, it was a big surprise to me and most of our staff. You know, the governor closed us. That was surprise enough. We hadn't been closed since the 1918 flu. And we said, well, don't worry. We'll cut our expenses so far down. We'll be okay. Well, doing everything we could only cut it by about one third because, you know, the vets have to be there. The keepers have to be there. We have to be able to feed everybody. Yeah. So we were going broke fast.
You can't turn the power off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it was something.
It's not like here where we just shut the building down and no one came back for a year. I mean, you got to keep things going.
And there were zoos nationwide. I mean, the National Zoo was closed for something like 18 months.
Yeah.
Now, I know they're funded through the Smithsonian, but we would have been done. I mean, there would be no possible way to have made it through 18 months of that. Monterey Bay Aquarium, similarly, was closed a real long time. But
of course, we know now
we were only closed 3 months.
Best place to be.
Exactly. So it worked out.
Well, this goes without saying. I mean, we have a world-class zoo here. You mentioned the National Zoo. When I was living in the D.C. area, I was really excited to go to the National Zoo. And I was like, oh, this is going to be fantastic. And I walked around. I was like, Cincinnati Zoo's better.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and it's a very similar because it's kind of urban and older and, you know, it's very different from like the San Diego Zoo.
Right.
But yeah, so Thane, we can't thank you enough for being here.
It's fun to do it.
I know. I loved hearing
everybody
about
get out to the zoo.
You both. And thanks for having me.
Yeah, we'll definitely make sure that we'll make it easy for people to find the motorcade of elephants.
Yeah.
There you go.
It was fun.
It all worked out. Everybody was very anxious when they got here, but it went very smoothly.
Did the elephants get to watch movies on their transatlantic flight?
They were just in there, but they had ample food. And on the plane, typically not a lot of people fly on those planes other than the pilots, but there were seven staff.
Wow.
One of our vets and our lead keeper who had been over there for over a month learning sort of about these animals hands-on. We'd had numerous keepers and curators over the period of the last year, but anyway, he was on the plane and also a veterinarian and the keepers from Dublin Zoo. So that was important because the elephants do see the people that they're familiar with as sort of as part of their herd.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks again, Thane. And we'll see everybody at Festival of Lights.
As usual, we could talk to our special guest for a very long time. Turns out he was really busy, though, and he had to go.
Had a meeting.
He did. But I was glad we got some updates. It's so fun. I can't wait for the elephant exhibit to open. That was fun to hear how that all went. I'm so glad for Ndume and how well he's doing. So there was a lot of good news in there. And of course, we learned about Fiona.
And I don't know what it is just about Thane. He can tell a story.
Yeah.
He could read the dictionary and it would sound compelling. He just has that way about him. So thanks, Thane. Now we're at the portion of the podcast. And he touched on this a little bit. You know, we call it That's So Cincinnati because there's just so many things that are so Cincinnati. And you have something that would fit the bill this week.
I do. I was off for Thanksgiving week. And on Wednesday, I ended up having a day bopping around Westwood. Westwood is Cincinnati's largest neighborhood, and it's so fun to like get out in the neighborhoods and see what each of them has to offer. And it's something, honestly, for every neighborhood. every neighborhood. I really do mean that. But Westwood has changed so much in really the last decade with the redoing of Town Hall and what's grown up around it. But yeah, I went with two of my best friends. We went to Frond, Jackie Frondorf's plant store. Her husband like throws all the pots. It was just so lush and beautiful in there. It's like the best hostess gifts are in there. And we had a really good time there. Then we went and we did a wellness treatment at By the Sea Salt Therapy, which I'm a little skeptical about wellness sometimes, but I have to tell you, I had the best night of sleep that I've had in, I can't how long.
Was it like massage, hot stones?
It's not. You just go in, it's a salt room.
A salt room?
With salt on the floor, on the walls, and put into the air.
A salt room.
And it's warm and balmy. Like
you're at the beach?
It was like just like being, they play with the sound of waves. And we just sat in there, had a glass of wine, and talked to each other, just like we would be like together and out. But it was super relaxing. And then we went.
All of this in Westwood.
All in Westwood. And then we went to Nation Kitchen, a previous guest of the podcast, Andrew Salzbrunn's, his restaurant. And we had fried bologna sandwiches, kind of like a burger. It was amazing.
With mayonnaise.
Yeah, it was so, I don't know if there was mayonnaise. I don't know. It was really good, though. Like the night before Thanksgiving, I was like, I'm eating fried bologna, but it was so good.
Pause there for a minute. When was the last time you had a bologna sandwich?
I know we were talking about that. I can't.
Phil, producer Phil, when was the last time you had a bologna sandwich?
It's
been
all the time in the 70s.
Now
for
I kind of want to buy a package of bologna and just eat it for nostalgia.
Go to Nation.
I'll go to Nation.
I can't.
But you can't eat a bologna sandwich on like, you know, 12 grain whole wheat bread. It has to be on white bread. Like
I did split it with one of my friends.
The kind of bread that you
so
could
good.
Ball it up in a ball and yeah.
So anyway, I encourage people really to explore our neighborhoods. It was a fun kind of random day.
That's a great That's So Cincinnati moment. Find a neighborhood and just hang out there. That's good. Well, mine is the quintessential Thanksgiving Cincinnati moment, and that's running in the Thanksgiving Day Run.
I know I was going to do it, and I didn't.
Oh, I'm so glad I did.
I didn't think I'd be covering a railroad, though, like I did, so that's
my
excuse.
Yeah, you needed some rest, yeah. But, you know, so they changed the course this year. Instead of crossing over into Kentucky and back, it was all on the Cincinnati side, but started and finished in the TQL Stadium area.
Did you miss running over the bridges? Because if someone had asked me, I would say no, but I know that there were some people who missed that. And I was like, how could you miss running over the bridges?
I mean, the course was great. I did kind of miss, you know, because I'm a traditionalist, you know, the race for me has always been, you know, and I know in its very long history, like 100-year history, it hasn't always gone over into Kentucky, but that seemed to me to be part of the charm about it. But yes, running bridges is challenging because they are hilly. When you're looking at them or driving over them, it doesn't seem like they would be hilly. But when you look at them, like with the discerning eye of a runner, you realize it's like a very steep, short uphill.
I always know when I'm in shape, can I run up it or do I have to walk up it?
Yeah, but overall, I mean, for the first year with that new course, I mean, they added what I wanted to mention. They added the 5K, which they haven't had. So there were way more runners out there than in past years. But what I like about it is the sense of community. Like you're out there, you know, I ran into a bunch of people I knew.
The mayor? Did you run into the mayor?
I did run into the mayor.
You guys, I slept in on Thanksgiving. I never sleep in. My alarm is set for 6 every day. I wake up at like 5:58. I just do every day of my life. I slept in on Thanksgiving and I woke up to a text from my boss and the mayor saying good morning from a race I thought that I would have been running, but it's like 10 o'clock in the morning. I think it was the fried bologna sandwich.
No. Oh, that's great because so yeah, the mayor was there, and so I actually said
you
to
are
him,
probably already at home. I thought to myself, those two are already at home. They've run race, and I'm just waking up.
So Aftab was there, and I said to him because you know you're a reporter. You don't give the mayor and the city council an easy pass. You ask tough questions. There are days that Aftab probably just sees red when he sees he's getting a call from you. But still, you have to kind of maintain a relationship with them, like all your sources. You don't want them to shut you down, the delicate balance, you know, that all journalists play. But that day, I thought it would be funny. I said to the mayor, let's take a quick selfie and send it to Sherry. And he was all about it. He's like, let's do that. But that's the kind of thing, you know, even if like by day you're adversarial, you know. At the Thanksgiving Day race, everybody's out there for a good time, and you're like chatting with strangers, and you know, the police officers and the sheriff's deputies that are out there making sure to keep, you know, cars off the course and everything like that. Everybody that runs by, they're like, thank you for being out here this morning. Happy Thanksgiving. It's just one of those, you know, you feel part, you feel that sense of community that is so Cincinnati that you don't feel in every town in this
nation.
So
what did you do after the race? Did you just go home? Did you go out?
I was busy because I had to make some, we didn't host Thanksgiving at my house. My sister did it. So I had, but we brought some food over. So we had to, you know, kind of finish that up. But, you know, I got home and it was a beautiful sunny day, and I thought, well, before I go in and shower and all that stuff, I need to like finish, get the last of the leaves, you know, cleared out, and so I actually like worked outside for a little bit when I first got home.
Alex covered up our faucets.
Oh yeah,
and the grill. He did some winterizing on Thanksgiving.
And get this, because last year I got stuck hanging. I think we had that early kind of snowstorm in December or whatever. It was like it got cold. We had a cold snap, and I remember hanging Christmas lights out. And it was so cold, like I was freezing. And it was just like, all right, I'm out here. I'm going to like get rid of the leaves that I haven't raked yet. And I'm going to put the Christmas lights up. And then I went to Thanksgiving. And then after that, well,
that's a long, you had to go to bed early that night.
My family was making fun of me because I was after the big Thanksgiving feast and we're all sitting there in my sister's living room. I did start to nod off.
But that's why you run the race.
They were comparing me to my dad. They're like, oh, you're just like dad, you're nodding off. And, you know, in the middle of all this like chaos, like, you know, all
but
this family's
there.
But
it's because you ran the race, and that's the point. You run the race.
You run the race, fill your belly up.
All those calories. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But no, it is a, like I said, the sense of community is very strong when you're like hanging out waiting for the race to start. So that was my, it's, you know, when we travel for Thanksgiving, I enjoy traveling to see family too, but I do miss, you know, that's kind of
I've
like,
I've actually run Thanksgiving races in other cities.
Yeah.
Which is fun because then you don't, the time flies by. If you run anywhere in some other city you've not been, there's so much to see.
Plus, this is a pro tip. If you need running gloves, they usually have a very nice pair of running gloves in the swag bag when you sign up for the race.
I just found this year under Jack's bed. I think it's from the 103rd Thanksgiving race, a pair of gloves. I was like, oh, I like these gloves.
So I got my orange 2023 Thanksgiving Day race gloves now that I'll probably use for the rest of the winter. And, you know, they have the tips that allow you to use your phone or your watch, you know, let the...
Fancy. Yeah, those are fancy.
Yes.
And a necessity if you honor your phone as much as we are.
Well, there we go. Thanks for listening, everybody.